Well, good afternoon and welcome, everybody. First of all, thank the participants. Thank you very much for agreeing to attend. I know that a number of you came from some significant distance, and some of you came from locations that at the end of June are probably preferable in many respects to downtown Washington, D.C., and so we thank you for taking the time to do this. I would like to point out that all of the PCOB board is here with us. Bill Gradison is here. Steve Harris is here. Dan Gelzer is here, and Charlie Niemeyer is here. So we are very well represented. The meeting will be conducted by Rhonda Schneer. Rhonda is the head of our Office of International Affairs, and with her as expert counsel are Gordon Seymour, General Counsel Carl Callender from our Inspections and Registration Group that has responsibility for international, and the Deputy Director, Karen Dietrich. The purpose here is to have a discussion on the criteria for an oversight system that would allow for the highest level of reliance under our Rule 4012 that has been out for comment that would allow us to rely on our foreign counterparts to the extent consistent with the law. When the Sarbanes-Oxley Act was passed, there was no reference to our international counterparts because, for the most part, we did not have international counterparts. The same combination of circumstances that created the need for Sarbanes-Oxley and as part of it, the PCOB in the U.S. has occurred around the world, which is to say that the issues around audit that have become a public policy issue. And so for we now have counterparts around the world doing the same, having the same function, have been given the same responsibility that we have. Additionally, over 800 of the 1,800 accounting firms that have registered with us are non-U.S. based. And so when you put the two of them together, the question is not, are we going to work with our counterparts around the world? The question is, how are we going to work with our counterparts around the world? We've had a number of written comments that were both insightful, I think, and diverse, and we're looking for some additional insight from you that will contribute to the board's deliberation on an ongoing basis. The panelists that are here today were selected because we have a range of views. I think that we have a full range of views represented in the room. I'm very confident because I know most, if not all of them, that we do not have shrinking violence in the room. So I expect that we will have a firm, full, and vigorous discussion. In fact, somebody asked me just a minute ago what I thought the result of the meeting was, and I said it would be that, a full and free discussion of the issues. That I expect that we will get in a measured and, if I may say so, respectful way as we communicate with each other. Rhonda is in charge. She has the baton, and so I will refer the meeting back to Rhonda at this point.
Thank you, Chairman Olson, and good afternoon, board members, distinguished panelists, and members of our listening audience on the web. First, let me join Chairman Olson in thanking all of the panelists for agreeing to participate in today's roundtable discussion. As Chairman Olson indicated, the PCOB convened this roundtable in order to provide the board with additional input on the issues that have been raised by the comment letters received on the board's proposed policy statement on the implementation of existing PCOB Rule 4012. By way of background, PCOB Rule 4012, which was adopted by the board in June 2004, permits the board to rely, to a degree it deems appropriate, on independent non-U.S. auditor oversight entities in connection with the required inspections of PCOB-registered non-U.S. firms. Under the rule, the board is guided by five principles in evaluating the independence and rigor of the non-U.S. oversight system to determine the appropriate degree of reliance along a sliding scale. After relying on several non-U.S. auditor oversight entities to a certain degree during the last 3 years, and in light of the many recent developments in auditor oversight around the world, the board issued for public comment a proposed policy statement to provide further guidance with regard to the implementation of Rule 4012 for the highest level of reliance on the rule's sliding scale. The proposed policy statement articulates 25 essential criteria that further define the five principles set forth in the rule. The proposed policy statement provides that if, after a period of joint inspections, the board finds that the essential criteria have been met, the board may place the maximum degree of reliance under Rule 4012, called full reliance in the proposed policy statement, on the inspections programs of qualified non-U.S. oversight entities. Full reliance is defined in the proposed policy statement to mean that, in general, the PCOB would rely on the non-U.S. regulator to plan the inspection, carry out the inspection field work, and make findings based on its field work. However, the proposed policy statement also states that the PCOB must have the opportunity to observe the inspections. The proposed policy statement points out that the level of observation may vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and even from inspection to inspection, but it could include going into the field with the non-U.S. inspections team and/or reviewing audit work papers. Reliance determinations under Rule 4012 are made or revisited by the board every year in which a registered non-U.S. audit firm is scheduled for an inspection intended to satisfy the requirements of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. This would also be true for full reliance determinations under Rule 4012. In developing the proposed policy statement, the board carefully considered the requirements of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the board's rules, and the policy considerations underlying the board's mandate to inspect registered audit firms, regardless of their location, in order to protect the interests of investors in U.S. public companies. In both the development of Rule 4012 and the proposed policy statement, the board chose not to adopt an approach of mutual recognition and did not exercise its exemption authority under Section 106 of the Act. Consequently, the board is mindful of the need to ensure that the approach set forth in the proposed policy statement complies with the requirements for inspections under Section 104 of the Act and the relevant PCAOB rules. Because the board would continue to retain regulatory jurisdiction over the firms under the proposed policy statement, the PCAOB would not relinquish its authority to conduct its own inspections of registered non-U.S. firms if the need arises or otherwise investigate and/or sanction such firms. In response to the proposed policy statement, the board received 37 comment letters. Although a broad range of comments were received, they may be grouped into two overall categories. One, general comments on the board's decision to undertake to issue the proposal, and two, comments on certain of the specific essential criteria set forth in the proposal. Given the complexity and importance of the issues raised in the comment letters, the board believes it would benefit from an exchange of views on certain specific issues. Thus, this roundtable is designed to provide the board with the opportunity to hear further discussion on important topics related to the proposal. The panelists were chosen because of their experience and interest in and their varying perspectives on these important issues. As I just mentioned, the format for today's roundtable is designed to provide additional input to the board. Because the board is still in the deliberative phase of considering the comments received, which will include the content of today's discussion, the roundtable is not designed for the panelists or the audience to ask the board members or PCOB staff questions. Discussion today will be divided into two sessions of approximately 90 minutes each. First, we will cover questions related to the proposed full reliance approach in general. And then after a short coffee break, we will cover questions related to some of the specific comments received on certain of the proposed essential criteria. The questions for today's roundtable have been posted already on the PCOB's website, as well as made available to those in attendance here in Washington. As I mentioned, we are broadcasting the discussion here live via the website, and it will be archived for those wishing to listen to it at a later date. I will moderate the discussion and will begin by posing questions to specific panelists. After that, I will open the floor for comments from other panelists. And so if you wish to respond or comment, please raise your name tent sitting in front of you. In some cases, I or members of the PCOB board may pose follow-up questions to the panel. We'll spend approximately 25 minutes on each question, and let me apologize in advance if there's not time for everyone to speak on every question. Before we get started, I want to introduce the panelists, so let me start from my left. For those of you listening, we have Peter Weinman, who is Managing Partner for Global Public Policy at PricewaterhouseCoopers. We then have Yunichi Maruyama, who is the Deputy Commissioner for International Affairs at the Japan Financial Services Agency. We then have Professor Vinod Shroff from KPMG International. He is the Chair of the Global Regulatory Group. We have Jeff Mahoney further down, who is General Counsel for the Council of Institutional Investors. Around the corner, we have Pierre Delceaux, who is the director from the Directorate General of Internal Market and Services from the European Commission. Next to him is Randy Fletchell. He is the Americas Vice Chair for Assurance and Advisory Business Services, Professional Practice and Risk Management at Ernst & Young. Next to him, we have Barbara Roper, who is the Director of Investor Protection from the Consumer Federation of America. After that, we have Stephen Maior. He is a director of the Netherlands Authority for Financial Markets. Next to him, we have Damon Silvers, who is Associate General Counsel with the AFL-CIO. We then have Lynn Turner, former Chief Accountant from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Jeff Wilmain, who is Global Managing Partner, Regulatory and Risk at Deloitte. Paul George, who is the Director, Professional Oversight Board in the United Kingdom, and then Mike Starr, who is Chief Operating Officer for Grant Thornton International. So let me welcome again all of our panelists and our board members and the rest of the audience here in Washington. With that, we will start with the questions. As I mentioned, we have two sessions. We have three questions here in the first session, and we're going to start with Jeff Wilmain from Deloitte and Pierre Delceaux for the first question, and then we will open it to the rest of the panel to comment. And the first question, let me begin. Since 2005, and consistent with Rule 4012, the PCOB has been able to conduct joint inspections with auditor regulators in five jurisdictions and PCOB-only inspections and approximately 15 other jurisdictions that do not currently have an auditor regulator conducting regular inspections. The question is, what obstacles exist in non-U.S. jurisdictions that could affect the PCAOB's ability to conduct inspections of non-U.S. firms going forward, either PCOB-only inspections or joint inspections? And in your view, can the proposed full reliance approach help to alleviate these obstacles? So let me start with Jeff.
Thank you, Rhonda. Thank you, Mark, for the introduction. I'll move forward. I'm going to offer two thoughts to get our discussion going. Before that, let me give just a little bit of context. I've had a global role in our organization, a couple of them, for the better part of the last 10 years. So my thoughts about this question are naturally informed, to some extent you may say biased, but they are naturally informed by that global experience. So I instinctively react to this question in the context of where Mark started our discussion, thinking of 1,800 registered audit firms around the globe. I think of the question in the context of all of those audit firms registering with multiple regulators. With that context, though, I'd like to be clear. The two thoughts I will put forth are not directed or meant at any other regulator. They are offered in the spirit of of how the PCAOB can best discharge its mandate by law outside of the U.S. borders. Now, when I hear the term non-U.S. jurisdictions, from where I sit, I instinctively think of non-Japanese jurisdictions, I think of non-German jurisdictions, I think of non-UK jurisdictions, I think of non-Dutch jurisdictions. And I think it's important to put today's discussion in a principled context that considers those corollaries, because they are real. They are very real. As we speak, our firms around the world are in the process of working through the implications of registering with Japan. They're working through the implications of registering with different regulatory bodies within the European community. All of those discussions are lively at this point, and all of those regulators from where we sit are contemplating their inspection approaches. So the intersection here in terms of the global environment is very, very timely, and it's very, very real. And my thoughts about, rather than using the term obstacles, I would use the term inefficiencies that I offer for you, contemplate the reality of those corollaries. Here's the first thought. If the principled underpinning of maximizing investor protection is that that be rooted in the processes of the national regulator, for example, if investors in French companies are best protected by the French regulator inspecting non-French firms doing work for French public companies, if that is your principled underpinning, then you enter a world of multiple independent or joint inspections for a large number of audit firms around the globe. In my view, this can result in unnecessary duplication by regulators. This is not a question of the rigor or the independence of the inspection process itself. It's a question of how often that inspection is undertaken and the dimensions and complexities that come into play when you have multiple inspections with respect to any one individual firm. Let me take the U.S. firms as an example. The U.S. firms are very large. They have tremendous scale and tremendous resource. Were the U.K., Netherlands, Germany, France, and Japan to embrace a national approach to their inspection policies, and therefore to decide to inspect our U.S. firm, I think there are implications for the participants in that process, including investors, that should be considered. If that participation was determined to be a joint inspection approach, similar to how the PCAOB is currently conducting its investigations overseas, it is difficult for us to contemplate how that would work with respect to the U.S. audit firms, considering how the findings of those inspections would be resolved, considering the difficulties and challenges on report issues, whether those are private or public. It is very difficult to envision a what you might term a United Nations type approach working well. If those regulators looked at the U.S. firms and concluded a standalone inspection would be appropriate, those same issues come up, but there are added complexities. How would the firms and how would participants in the inspection process react to a material finding of one regulator that was not found by others? Different observations that come forward. This would be a confusing, difficult environment to work in. Now, moving out of the U.S. firms and just dropping into smaller firms, the challenges are significant, and a lot of those have to do with scale. Our experience has been in reviews of our audit firms around the globe that are outside of the large-scale practices. The inspections take about 2 weeks. They involve 10 or 12 partners. If there's a foreign private issuer audit, you have a senior manager working exclusively on that inspection process for about 2 weeks. There's leadership time, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the issue is not that inspection per se. The issue is when you imagine three or four of those processes in a particular audit firm of smaller scale. And I would suggest that would be an inappropriate amount of time spent dealing with multiple processes, particularly considered they all share a common objective, and certainly over time they will have a common methodology. Common objective, common methodology, multiple inspections is a world that's difficult to envision an appropriate use of resources. There are legal impediments to this. I'm not going to comment on that, but as a general rule, the legal impediments country by country can generally be better dealt with as you move up the spectrum to full reliance. So as a practical matter, I'd suggest that from a global perspective, considering where we are in terms of the reality of the world and the development of inspection processes globally, it's important to move to or consider a full reliance approach that would deal with these inefficiencies I mentioned. A couple of final thoughts. Familiarity with culture, the professional environment, legal and governance structures and practices, and specific risks within a given country lends itself to a more robust inspection from our point of view, accepting, of course, that the methodologies and the conduct of the inspection are independent and rigorous. We've certainly learned this over the years in terms of how we conduct audits. We see that as the familiarity grows through the bilateral discussions in the regulatory community, a convergence of inspection techniques and methodologies and best practices will be shared. And we think that a premise that says once you have a common methodology, a common objective, it must be executed in multiple times for a specific firm will not serve the community well. Mutual trust and learning, we think, should be top of mind. This can be accomplished through the full reliance approach by establishing communication protocols, which otherwise might be anchored in joint inspection timing. We see all of these advantages as points that could be achieved in a full reliance approach, which, as Rhonda, you outlined, does not preclude participation, observation, and sharing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jeff. And now let me turn to Pierre for a reaction from the European Commission.
Thanks, Rhonda. Thanks, Mark. I don't like to start by negative messages about obstacles. I always prefer to look at the bright side of life. So I would start maybe by two more general remarks, which are probably obvious, but it's always good sometimes to repeat the obvious. First of all, as Mark said, globalization is a fact. Whatever we want, whatever we do, whatever we would prefer, globalization is a fact and will remain a fact in the future. And let's be clear, if globalization is a fact, no one, no single jurisdiction can resolve all the problems linked to globalization alone. We don't have a choice. Second remark, more general remark. Why are we doing what we do? Basically for investor protection. We want all this to be in the interest of investors. We want to make sure that our investors will invest in appropriate companies and will be protected by auditors. That's why we have all this legislation all around the world. But again, my message here will be very clear. We are all motivated by the same objective. No country has a monopoly of investor protection. We all want to protect investors, but of course, to achieve the same goal, we might do it in different manners. Does it mean that it is bad? No. It's simply different means to achieve the same objective. And that's why in Europe we are so keen to talk about equivalence. Equivalence means achieving the same results, but not exactly being identical. And we consider this concept to be fundamental. Now, you asked me to talk about obstacles. Yes, if we don't cooperate, what will be the obstacles? Let's be very clear, and let's be concrete, if you want me to be concrete. In Europe, data protection will prevent you to get information. We will not give you information because of our data protection legislation, which is very strict. Acceding to audit working papers will be extremely complicated when the new directive will enter into force, simply because we have in some member states legislations preventing exchanging these documents. And again, let's be clear also, the question of inspection reports, you wanted an open discussion, is a sensitive one because that's an issue on which we won't like to have also some kind of reciprocity cooperation. So if we don't have some kind of consensus, some kind of agreement between us, many practical obstacles will exist. Let's face it. And it's not good to hide that and to believe that we will not be faced with these obstacles. Now, of course, you can say, who cares? Let's keep our legislation, the community, its own legislation, the US, its own legislation, Japan, its own legislation. But are we going to achieve investor protection like this? First of all, the markets are much more clever than we are. If we behave like this, what will be the end result? I mean, the issuers will delist, will go elsewhere, will go to less protected markets, and the investors will increase investments without any kind of protection. Look at the trend. Look at the move of US investors going abroad, European investors going abroad. That's exactly the situation. So if we don't do anything, investors and the markets will move. And my second remark, if we don't cooperate, what does it mean? It means that basically we will not exchange best practices between us. We will not learn from each other's experiences. We will not improve our own systems. You know, the community is based on cooperation. The community is based on exchanging information and best practices. By doing so, we have improved the situation in all member states. I'm not only talking about the audit sector, I'm talking more generally speaking. I mean, if we have a real cooperation between us, we will learn each other how to improve the system for the sake of investor protection. And I'm not, you know, saying nice words because it's good to say this kind of nice words in such an audience. It's the reality of what we want to do in Europe. And to be very concrete with you, also to be very clear with you, we have chosen the second option in Europe. We have chosen the option of cooperation. And we are now in the process of finalizing technical measures to accept firms, audit firms from certain third countries, not all third countries, but certain third countries on a temporary basis, and give us time to make an assessment of their systems. And again, we will publish the technical criteria which will guide the community in assessing equivalence of those third countries. And why do you see a merit in that? Because simply when you explain which criteria you expect, the result will be that these jurisdictions will move and will try to comply with this criteria. So basically, you are creating a momentum which is good for everybody, for all investors, for investor protection everywhere in the world. And that's what we want to achieve, because to start again, to finish really by what I started, we live in a global world. Thank you.
Thank you, Pierre. So before I ask any follow-up questions myself, does any of the other panelists want to comment right away? Okay. Barbara?
You know, as I listen to these comments, and having read the comment letters, it strikes me that the obstacles we've been told that exist for non-cooperation exist under full reliance, too. I mean, we've been told that in the comment letters that we should accept as part of full reliance the scope limitations that exist in the inspections in the home country, the very limited access to audit work papers, still problems about the inspection reports. So I don't see that those problems go away. There's no evidence to me that those problems go away under assistance of full reliance. We're just being asked to accept them. And, you know, that doesn't actually strike me as cooperation. You know, joint inspections strike me as a very cooperative method in which we learn best practices from each other, in which we work side by side and learn from each other in a way that we don't once we walk away from that process and turn it over to another oversight body with, again, if we accede to the comments in the letters, very limited opportunity for any kind of meaningful oversight. And, you know, and some of these obstacles that we're being told exist, I mean, they're not natural features of the landscape. They are barriers that have been erected, and in very many cases have been erected since the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley, in what appears to be an attempt either to simply ignore the PCAOB's obligations under U.S. law, or, you know, to make it impossible for it to comply with U.S. law, which clearly requires the PCAOB to regulate foreign audit firms in the same manner and to the same extent as it does firms that are audit, that are domiciled in the United States. And so, you know, I feel for the PCAOB. It's been put in a very difficult position. It's facing demands overseas or obstacles overseas that essentially prevent it from complying with Congress's clear intent in passing the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. I mean, this wasn't unanticipated when Sarbanes-Oxley was debated. These issues were on the table. They were in amendments that were proposed in the conference committee. I mean, they discussed these issues and they rejected this approach because they said it would create an unacceptable investor protection loophole. The board previously determined that this approach would never be in investors' interests or in the public interest because other oversight bodies do not share the mission of protecting U.S. investors and enforcing compliance with U.S. laws and U.S. regulations. So, you know, I feel for the board. I'd feel for the board a little more if the board didn't seem to be such a willing victim in all of this. And I don't know what the best approach is to resolving some of these issues that have been raised that make it very difficult, if not impossible, for the PCAOB to do its job. But I know that this proposal isn't it.
Well, we've got a couple cards here. I think, Damon, I think yours went up. Yours went up first, so I'll call on you.
First, I have to apologize. I have to go to my office to meet with the president of the AFL-CIO in a few minutes, and I'll be on for about half an hour. So if I make my comments and leave, I understand. I apologize. For the benefit, some of us are very well known to each other and spend a lot of time in this room. Others of us are not. I represent the AFL-CIO, which is the Federation of America's Labor Unions. I believe we are the largest labor federation in the world. Our members have $5 trillion invested on their behalf in the global capital markets, including increasingly large amounts of money invested in non-U.S. markets in Europe and in Japan. This is the fourth major gathering around international capital markets regulation that I've been to in the last week. I was at the International Corporate Governance Network's annual meeting in Seoul, South Korea on Wednesday and Thursday, speaking to these issues in the context of the credit crisis. I was in a meeting at Stanford Law School in California with the chairman of the SEC on Sunday, and participated by video conference in a meeting with European parliamentarians and finance ministry officials in Brussels on Monday morning. In each of the meetings prior to this one, I found that, as between investors, workers' representatives, regulators, parliamentarians, there's a fair amount of consensus and understanding that we need quite strong global regulation, a global regulatory framework, and a comprehensive one to address the circumstances and weaknesses that have revealed themselves in the last year or two. This is a consensus and a view, I think, that crosses many of these boundaries. It's a consensus shared by our compatriot pension fund organization in Japan, with whom I spent some time with in Seoul. It's a consensus shared by leaders of many of the nations of the European community. It's a consensus that we in the American labor movement are very strongly supportive of. So it surprises me that this meeting begins on such a sort of sharp tone, given, I think, where everyone else seems to be. But I would just say this, that everyone has a card to play in a game of mutually assured destruction. If that is the game that people want to play, I assure you we have cards too. I've got a list of phone numbers from Seoul and I can start calling them. And I've got a list of phone numbers in Brussels, and I'll start calling them. The objective here should not be for us all to pull our Rolodexes out and start calling. It should be to develop a protocol by which it is possible, based on the sorts of standards that investors globally expect in terms of independence and oversight, to develop a set of protocols to capture the potential gains from cooperation that our French colleague laid out in the latter part of his remarks. I must say, I just don't believe that the time frame that is in front of us is sufficient to capture, to achieve that goal. The time frame that the board is trying to act on, and I'm sympathetic with the board and the situation the board is in. I think this is complicated. It's complicated substantively and complicated politically. And getting it wrong, playing the game of mutually assured destruction, would be very costly indeed. And so I urge you, as I walk out on you, I urge you to I'm coming back. I urge you to explore without. I mean, we all know, to use someone else's expression, that there may be a shotgun by the door. But I urge you all to explore, in my absence a bit, exactly what the parameters might be that would need to be delved into over a sustained period of time, to see if this could be placed on a more friendly basis, and if we could indeed capture, I think, the common desire of all the people that we represent here, that we have a strong global system that gives investors confidence and gets us past the current crisis in our markets, of which this issue of auditors and auditing quality is certainly relevant to that crisis. So, and again, thank you, and I apologize. I'm stepping out.
All right, thank you, Damon. Actually, Paul George from the UK has your name sent up, and Paul, I know you've got a comment you want to make, but I wonder if in the course of that, if you could also maybe address. I mean, the question really is about what obstacles do you think joint inspections would face going forward? As I mentioned in the preface to the question, you know, the PCAOB has been able to do successful joint inspections, and in fact, as you can attest, we've been doing them with your organization for the last few years. So, you know, what obstacles would we face going to continue to do those that the approach set forth in the proposed policy statement might alleviate? If you can.
Yeah. Thank you, Vonda. I will try and pick those points up towards the end of my comments. I just wanted to follow up on a couple of comments that have already been made. Before doing so, perhaps I can just thank the PCAOB for organising this event. I think it's a very important topic that all of us in this room feel very strongly about. We may have a different perspective on it, but it's only by getting around this table and discussing the issues that we're likely to find the appropriate solution. And again, I think we should all remind ourselves we do have a common objective here. All of the oversight bodies represented here, they may be set up in a slightly different manner, but they have a common objective to the PCAOB, as indeed do the audit firms, in terms of actually high-quality audits to ensure the strength of the capital markets, and in so doing, helping to protect investors. I think we should also remind ourselves what the policy statement is about. The policy statement is about what is necessary for full reliance. It is not a statement about what might be the position if a non-US regulator has some of the essential criteria or meets some of the principles, and therefore something less than full reliance is appropriate. So what we're talking about here is where a foreign regulator can clearly demonstrate to the satisfaction of the PCAOB board that they can achieve similar objectives to that the PCAOB seeks to achieve, then it's appropriate to place reliance on that, and therefore we can devote risks to the appropriate parts of the marketplace. As Rhonda says, in the UK we have had some joint inspections with the PCAOB, and I think they have been largely successful. I think fair to say, and I hope the PCAOB would agree with this, I think we've both learned a lot from them. I think we'd all agree, and we have through the international regulatory community, we have a number now of opportunities to discuss and share ideas about how we go about inspections. And not one body has all the answers, and by working together and sharing these ideas, we're likely to do a better job to protect investors. And therefore, we have learned from working with the PCAOB, and I believe the PCAOB has learned from working with the UK as well. So it's been a beneficial process. I think it's also fair to say that the inspection was led by the UK. Well, that's a matter of fact. It was led by the UK. But there wasn't any issues that were identified during the inspection process where we actually reached a different conclusion. And therefore, based on that joint inspection and based on our continued knowledge of each other, I think we have demonstrated that we would reach, perhaps in a slightly different manner from time to time, but we'd reach similar conclusions. And I think that's quite important. If at any point in the future it became apparent that our system was poorly funded, our system lacked the rigour that was necessary to meet the requirements for full reliance, or the fact that our system perhaps ceased to have the required level of independence, then I think it's right that one should question whether a full reliance approach continues to be the right way forward. But I think if you are going to rely, if you are going to have full reliance, it should be full reliance and not some halfway house of joint inspections, which I think are far more appropriate once you've established mutual trust in each other's systems, which are more appropriate when the non-US regulator perhaps hasn't got yet in place the systems necessary that justify that. Rhonda specifically asked me to pick up on what are the obstacles. I mean, there are a number of obstacles, and we had to try and find ways through some of those as we were working, and I think by and large, with goodwill on both sides, we did find some way through the issues that we needed to work through. We have, similar to requirements of Sarbanes-Oxley that was introduced into the US, in Europe, as you will all be familiar, we've introduced new requirements to strengthen across the whole of Europe the regulatory framework, and part of that are provisions in there which govern cooperation. Pierre has mentioned that. The idea of those provisions were to ensure that we have common standards across Europe to make sure that we could cooperate when it was appropriate to cooperate, and therefore other jurisdictions in Europe whose professional secrecy rules, which perhaps wouldn't have allowed cooperation until the statutory audit directive, post the statutory audit directive, there is a mechanism for that to take place, and therefore that's a positive step, and rather than a barrier to future cooperation, it's actually an assistance. But it does mean that you can only cooperate with somebody that can afford appropriate protection to the information that's shared.
Thank you. Yunichi from Japan Financial Services Agency.
Thank you, Rhonda. First, just would like to say thank you very much for providing us this kind of excellent opportunity for expressing our views, our standpoint, and we really appreciate that this kind of procedure, and also that we try to contribute as much as possible to this occasion. And as Mr. Wilman said, that Japan has also, that we have just introduced our new system of the foreign, non-Japanese, not U.S., non-Japanese audit firms registration system. And we are now preparing for those kinds of mutual reliance type of the framework together with the European friends and American friends. So it's a situation is pretty much similar. However, there's one big difference between American approach and Japanese approach. The U.S. approach, just would like to draw attention of every member of the PCAOB, you say that the full reliance, but you never say mutual reliance. Full reliance means that PCAOB, from always that looking from the PCAOB standpoint, whether that we can rely on the non-US, you know, oversight for this system or not. Whether PCAOB can get the information from outside. Even the joint inspection, which Barbara, you mentioned. Joint inspection means that the U.S. inspector is getting outside and have the joint inspection. Never mention the joint inspection. Other countries' inspection are coming in and have a joint inspection here in the United States. So as a result, what happens? As Pierre mentioned, that information exchange, inspection report. Yes, we are ready. Of course, there is a lot of confidentiality requirement and things that aside from those technical issues, the PCAOB people's attitude is because of the Sarbanes-Oxley, they cannot provide the inspection report. So please go to the audit firms so that audit firms that will submit the inspection report to the Japanese authority, European authority, whatever authority. We go to the audit firm, then that we encounter that very serious issues, privilege. It's not clear for us that the privilege is given by the state authorities or state legislative framework or because of the Sarbanes-Oxley is a federal law. So those privileges are applied to every, you know, state audit firms. We don't know. But there is a big question mark. So because of those privilege issues, audit firms are very reluctant to provide the inspection report to the outside authorities. So we get stuck, right? PCAOB that is getting that the inspection report from us, we can provide, or our audit company that we can allow our audit company to provide to their inspection report, our inspection report to the PCAOB. But we can't get it, neither from PCAOB nor from audit company. It's nowhere, right? This is a full reliance. This is not a mutual reliance. Another point is, for example, that if you look at this December notice, it's press this principle one, and it says that the five that the non-US oversight systems inspection staff must have sufficient expertise, skills, experience, blah, blah, blah. That's fine. Perfect. And must have sufficient expertise in applicable U.S. laws, regulations, and professional standards. Seems perfect. However, this requires that the Japanese inspectors to be knowledgeable on U.S. regulation laws and everything. If the U.K. starts requesting the same thing, if France starts requesting the same thing, if Germany starts requesting the same thing, what happens? Everywhere in the world. Japanese inspector has to be familiar with the U.S. law, French law written in French, German law written in German. So what I would like to propose is that the probably home country approach might be more reasonable and realistic. So just to rely on the other's system, inspector's ability, and also to get the result of those kind of inspection done in each country, and mutually relying on each other. That might be that much more realistic and sort of like a gentle approach rather than causing the conflict of with each other's authorities. I have one more the issue to be discussed, but I think that this issue, which is that the publication of the inspection report will be discussed later on, so that I will defer that my comments later on. Thank you.